Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest is Jen Stout, author of Night Train to Odessa, Covering the Cost of Russia's War, published today by Polygon. As a teenager in the Shetland Islands, Jen Stout fell in love with Russia, and later with Ukraine, their languages, cultures, and histories. Although life kept getting in the way, she eventually managed to pause her career as a BBC Scotland journalist and take up a nine-month scholarship to live and work in Russia. Unfortunately, this dream only came true in November 2021 as Russian troops massed on Ukraine's borders. 3 months later, she left Russia, but only as far as Vienna before heading back into Ukraine via Romania with a rucksack and a handful of freelance strings. In Night Train to Odessa, we experience Europe's biggest land war since 1945 through the eyes of a war reporter, photographer, and cultural observer during her contrasting tours in Kyiv, Kharkiv, Odessa, Lviv, and near the front line in Donbass. Via railway workers, soldiers, writers, activists, and old women sleeping in bunkers, we encounter stoical resistance. She writes, "I was finding warmth and determination all over the place when what editors expected was fear and despair. I tried to explain that the resilience I described wasn't an individual phenomenon but society-wide. The more Russia attacked Ukrainian society, the less inclined people were to anything remotely resembling despair. They only got angrier." Jen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So where are you at the moment? I know that until pretty recently you've been in Kharkiv, which is under what sounds like heavy Russian bombardment. How much has it changed since you were there in the book?
I was in Kharkiv, a week ago, 2 weeks ago. It's very, very difficult there now. And in some ways, it's almost reminiscent of like the really bad days of the early invasion of March 22, when the Russians were bombing with total impunity. They were using aerial bombs from planes. That has kind of started again. They're still not able to put planes over the city, but they've actually just put wings onto some of their bigger bombs, and that allows them to almost glide them into Kharkiv as well as lots of Ukrainian position. It's very, very hard for people. There's lots of long blackouts, and there's lots of fear about what's next. So it was very difficult for me to see it like that. I really love Kharkiv. It has a special place in my heart and has ever since I first went there in 2018, I think. But yes, right now I just got home. I'm in Edinburgh. I just moved to Edinburgh from Shetland. I love Shetland, but it's very difficult to do this kind of job from up there. Yeah, and I did a few pieces for various outlets from Kharkiv, for Prospect and for the Sunday Post, just kind of summing up the situation there.
Of the people you wrote about in the book based in Kharkiv, have any of them left?
No, none of them has left, on principle as much as anything, I think. I mean, I think they're aware that they might have to leave. They might have to be a little bit more ready for evacuation, either if Russia really begins bombing the place in earnest. I mean, at the moment, the strikes are now and then. If it becomes all the time and it's the city centre, then I think they would leave or stay and fight, to be honest, with the people that I know, very likely to stay and try and defend the city. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of fear around. There's a lot of what people might say is disinformation. They don't know where it's coming from, but these kind of rumours swirling around about what Russia might do next. Fed by the Russians as well. Obviously, you had Lavrov saying the other day that taking Kharkiv was a prime target and prime objective for the Kremlin. So it's deeply worrying for that city. They need air defence. They must have air defence.
Well, fortunately, that sounds like it is going to be on its way. It's a question of timing, though, right?
Yeah, and priority. I mean, which city do you prioritise? I understand they have to prioritise the capital, possibly Odessa as the port, but Kharkiv is hugely important to Ukraine as well.
Okay, so let's come to the book and let's start with your childhood in Shetland and how it was that, as you put it, quote, Russia snared you.
It did. I was a discontented teenager, Tim, and up in Shetland. I got to about 15. I wasn't really going to school that much. I was skiving a lot. And I'd done German and French and I didn't really like them. No offence to any speakers of that language. And then there was a chance to study Russian as a kind of in-between class, in the Scottish education system, you had this intermediate level. So I just had this one incredible teacher. So he was a Shetlander, Marian Ockenden. And it was quite a small class. And I, for some reason, it was like I already knew it. you know, and I just had to learn the grammar, which I loved because it was all about rules and everything was very straightforward. And I love the sounds of the language. And then I started reading about, you know, the history, the culture, politics. I started following the work of Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist at Novaya Gazeta. And the whole thing did. It absolutely, it snared me. It snared me. This incredible teacher took us on a school trip, if you can believe, from Shetland to St. Petersburg in sort of early 2000s, this was, in the 2000s. And I'd never really been abroad. So can you imagine, you know, as from a croft on an island, a tiny island, and suddenly you're looking down from a plane on this huge industrial city and this completely foreign culture and just being swept away by it.
Was this the first major city you'd ever been to? Had you been to Edinburgh or Glasgow? Or?
I've been to London, yeah, I guess. And Aberdeen, if you can count that as a major city. Shetland, just spend a lot of time in Aberdeen waiting for the boat. Yes, I've been to London. Nothing really prepared me for Russia, though. I mean, I suppose it is the differentness of it, isn't it? And when you're that age, you're very impressionable. I think I still am, you know, like when I'm in a new place, I'm like a big chipmunk with the giant eyes just completely swept away by everything and soaking it all in.
That really comes across in the book, actually. Also on your Twitter feed.
What do you mean?
Yes, you come across as somebody who is just excited with life.
Oh, that's nice. I try to be, and I often am. I'm really an optimist, and I find a lot of beauty in unexpected things, and that's a great joy.
Did this teacher inspire other people in your class, or were you a one-off?
I think they enjoyed it, but I was possibly a one-off in my sheer enthusiasm. And I mean, I remember taking in textbooks, my jotter, and she'd set some handwriting exercises so that we would learn Cyrillic handwriting. It's very, very joined up, recursive. And I remember taking this jotter into Mrs. Ockenden and sort of presenting it proudly. And it was, she just leafed through it, and it was, I mean, pages and pages. I mean, I stayed up all night just practicing Russian cursive handwriting. That was that level of obsession. I think, I mean, my life was a little bit tricky at that time, my home life. And I think I absorbed myself into this Russian language, and it absorbed me and gave me a great focus. And that, you know, that made me want to study for my exams and go to university, which I hadn't really wanted to do before. It really gave me a focus in life, something that I thought I could be good at and really enjoy.
One thing I really appreciated about the book, and as a former journalist myself, there's a lot of touching on the craft, and particularly the sort of hard craft, being a freelance. I really appreciated how you wrote about how difficult it was to get on in the profession. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I think it's getting worse, actually. And that really saddens me, that journalism is becoming much more of a middle or upper class pursuit because of the unpaid internships, the extortionate costs and the need to, you know, do a master's for £10,000 and live in London. I mean, who can actually do this? And I think foreign reporting is particularly bad for this because you have to have the money to go in the first place. And, you know, yeah, there's ways maybe you can teach English, you know, there's different ways you can do this. But I did spend quite a lot of time listening to interviews with correspondents who all had, you know, the same accent. And they all just said, oh, you know, I just went. And it's very difficult to hear that when you've tried so hard all the way through your 20s to just go. I pursued so many opportunities and all of them just needed money, which I didn't have any of at all. So it is difficult. To kind of find your path. I ended up working for the BBC for a while and that taught me a lot, and it also opened a lot of doors, I suppose. So I was constantly applying for fellowships and scholarships and just anything to get to Eastern Europe, actually, not particularly Russia, but just to Eastern Europe. And I finally got one, but it was far too late. You know, it was November 21 when we finally went to Moscow, and it was too late for everything. It was too late to do real reporting. It was too late politically. And then obviously we left a few months.
Even when you're there, when you're in Romania, when you're in Ukraine, you're constantly pitching for work. I remember these two scenes, one where you're recording something, I think, for the BBC from inside a padded wardrobe. And another time when you have to rush to get to a nightclub in Ukraine.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's exclusive to freelancers. I mean, it's a tough job for anyone, like staff or freelancers, to be honest. You're moving from place to place. You're constantly having to sort of put your face in order to look like calm and collected on the TV, if that's what you're doing. It's hard for everybody. I wouldn't want to claim I find it particularly difficult. But yes, I mean, I think the constant pitching and changing stories and adapting to you know, whatever the needs are of the day is difficult. We were down on the, I was on the border in Romania with a friend who's a TV producer. So we thought, well, we'll just make a package. And there was, you know, some agreement in with one major broadcaster. And then, you know, they dropped it because they had their own correspondent who decided to go there. And it's that kind of like constant, it is a bit of a grind. Whereas when I started working for a newspaper, for the Sunday Post in Scotland, which is a fantastic newspaper. We used to have great newspapers in Scotland, and now they're, I'm afraid, few and far between. But I started just freelancing for them on that border, and that was so much better because you get to, partially the way that you get to interact with people, do you know, to like sit down and talk to them and look into their eyes and tell them about yourself as well, and really have that kind of hour-long chat with them that you can then turn into an interview, into a story. Whereas, you know, if you're having to film for TV, it's much more obtrusive. It's much more, it feels more, to me, more exploitative. So I was very lucky to fall in with that newspaper. They commissioned me many more times, and I've worked closely with them for the last 2 years. I think that was a giant stroke of luck in what I was doing, because I was completely unknown, you know, just going off to Romania to the border and saying, oh, hello, I'm here. I think I can do this.
At what point did it occur to you that you could turn this into a book? And were you inspired by any other books of reportage like this?
Well, the idea of writing a book came, it was always kind of there. I'd always wanted to write books, really. But the idea, I mean, as the reporting went on, I suppose, through that period of April, May, June, I was gathering so much material. And, you know, so much more than you can ever get into the articles or the radio broadcasts. And the idea that I could really tell this story in a much fuller way with all the descriptions of the places as well, and really wanted to put that in. So that started to grow. And I had an agent already from a previous previous book that I did not write, but I was talking to my agent and to a publisher here. So that all just started to develop at that point. And I think I had it in mind as I was gathering material and sort of filing all my photos and my I mean, I keep a very detailed diary as well, and that really helps with writing the book. So possibly I had that in mind the whole time if I look back on it. Obviously, I've read lots of books by correspondents, and what I always liked were the ones where the reporter was not invisible. I didn't want to write a book with this very sort of, I'm not judging them for doing that, you know, that's a style of writing, but where the correspondent moves from place to place, you don't really know how they get there or who they're with or what they're feeling. They just give you the kind of very straight reporting. And I always loved reading the books where you got a feeling of their inner emotions, you know, and what it was actually like to do this, the details of this, and also how they felt about the situation. And I'm thinking obviously of Martha Gellhorn, who's I've always loved her writing and her position on things, you know. And it's her reporting was so it was straight reporting in many senses. You know, there's the what, why, and where, and you learn a lot from her dispatches and her books. But in between that, she puts those little details. There's nothing over-egged. There's nothing sentimentalized. And despite this, it's packed with feeling. I mean, that's such a skill. That's such a skill. And also humor sometimes. John Steinbeck actually wrote a book, Once There Was a War, and it was a collection of his dispatches. He was American, obviously, but he reported from the UK during the Second World War and then from Africa and Italy. And it's so beautiful and lyrical, but it's not sort of sentimentally beautiful. It's so vivid, but also funny. They put in these bits of humor. And the point I want to make about Gellhorn as well, that I always really admired, is that she, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as her to say like all that objectivity shit that she famously said, but I do believe in an element of objectivity and neutrality, but this is about fascism right now, and just as it was in the 1930s. And she rallied against that, thought journalism could be a powerful tool to warn of the rise of fascism, and was hugely disillusioned when nobody really listened in time. So those kind of writers have always hugely inspired me, how to combine that reporting and telling the truth with moving people with emotions.
It's interesting you say that, because towards the end of the book, I think it was when you were in Kharkiv, actually, you talk about how you felt you had changed. So you said, quote, "I'd grown up blissfully ignorant of such hard choices, far from war, where it had been easy to adopt knee-jerk pacifism. War was something I associated with British colonialism. It was easy to be against it." Is that something that changed when you were in Ukraine, or is it something that you felt had been changing before that?
It would have been changing before that. Yeah, my general understanding, or my moral position, if you want, on when sometimes you have to fight. I'd always read a lot about the Spanish Civil War, and you know, I would never have said I was a pacifist straight out, because I believe people have the right to defend themselves, particularly in sort of, you know, situations of imperialism and conquest, which Russia and Ukraine is. But the very visceral stuff of that, you know, actual soldiers, guns, you know, the real reality of war and death, I would have had a knee-jerk aversion to, I suppose is what I mean. And I had to deal with that. I mean, I still, to be clear, war is disgusting. It's abhorrent. But I understand that you have to fight. And I was proud of my friends who went to fight for their own country in Ukraine. And of some of the people I met who were fighting, and it wasn't even their country. They just believed in the cause. They believed it was necessary and they could be useful. But yes, I think you're talking about the, possibly it's a time in Kharkiv where I'd gone to, it was a fundraiser. They were streaming sort of poetry readings and music to a club in Germany, and everyone was raising money that way for the army. And I was in this bunker with some of my friends and interviewing people, and it was this incredibly heady atmosphere, kind of, I mean, really early in the full-scale invasion, so it's quite dangerous outside and we were down underground. What I had to think about then, what really struck me, was that there were soldiers there who'd just come back from the front, which was just outside the city, and there were people there who had brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers who were at the front line. And I thought, this isn't the army as I would understand it, although for me, the army is something distant. Now, for these people, the army is your immediate family. It's the people you know who are keeping you safe just a few miles away. I will never forget that kind of realization, that feeling of how important that was.
You also write about these strange alliances that pop up during wartime. And the one that really jumped out was your friend Ivana, who's an activist and a writer in Kharkiv. And she tells about how she'd formed an alliance with the Kharkiv Freikorps, which is essentially a far-right militia. And the first guy she'd ever cried for was its leader, who died in battle.
Yeah, she had written that on Facebook and got a lot of kickback from some of his friends and comrades. So Ivana telling me that story, we're sitting on a bench in about May 2022 in Kharkiv. And she just sort of casually told me this story, sort of something interesting that had happened in the last few months. And to me, it explains so much. Just to wind back a bit, I'd been in Kharkiv in 2018 and I'd met Ivana. She'd introduced me to some LGBTQ activists, and I had gone to speak to them just to kind of get more of an understanding. And at that time, people like Georgi and his lot, the Freikorps and these guys, they were the reason partly that they couldn't put on a Kharkiv Pride March, because they would always come and throw stuff at them and attack them. And so they're not natural allies. These guys are natural enemies. But Ivana had always had this very clear-sighted view of things. And actually, so did the people I'd spoken to in 2018, because I remember they were talking about donating to various groups and militias that they didn't like, but they knew that they had to, because these were the only guys able to do, you know, Ukraine's army in 2014, remember, was extremely weak. And it was these kind of militias, these unofficial groups, that fought back the Russian invasion at that point. And everybody understood that. You might not like them, but they understood that they're better than, you can hold your nose and support these groups, because it's much better than Russian occupation, particularly for LGBTQ people and activists who are very dangerous in the Russian occupation. And again, it's that kind of compromise. Ivana had said to this guy, when the tanks roll in, you and me will be on the same side. And I think that's incredibly farsighted of her, because everyone else was in complete denial about the fact that tanks might roll into Kharkiv, but she certainly wasn't, and she understood what was necessary.
I've jumped around a bit, so I'm going to go back when you first left Vienna and then went back into Ukraine via Romania. Hmm. The chapter on Romania was really interesting. It could just be me, but I think there is a tendency for people who sort of pride themselves on a specialism in European affairs to know much more about Western Europe than about Eastern Europe, and certainly about east of Eastern Europe. Your description of border Romania is really fascinating, this idea of Dobrogea and the Delta, 14 nationalities who live there, and this group of Russian religious exiles from the 19th century, the Lipovans. Was this something that you knew about before you went, or did you learn while you were there?
No, I had no idea. I had no idea. I think you're right that there's too much focus on Western Europe. There's too much study of Western Europe and not enough understanding of these places. And I'm guilty of that as well, because I didn't know anything about this part of Romania. I went there because I was sitting in Vienna for a couple of days. I just left Moscow very quickly, obviously. And I was staying at a friend's and thinking, well, where the hell am I going to go? I didn't want to go home. And I thought, well, there's these big border crossings. You know, I could go there and speak to some of the people fleeing from Ukraine and do a bit of freelancing. And I was looking at the map, and a lot of the big border crossings, you know, Siret, Medica, they were very well covered by lots and lots of journalists. And I thought that was probably not going to work that well. But I spoke to a friend who actually used to be the nurse in Fair Isle, in the island I come from. And she was very involved, as everybody was, with this massive civic network that has sprung up all across Europe, all across Eastern Europe, especially to help Ukrainians. And she said, Jen, you need to go to Izatia. It's the border crossing. It's on the Danube, just before the Delta, way down in southeast Romania. There's hardly any journalists there. I can get you there. Just get yourself to Bucharest. I'll find you a lift. And she did. And I honestly, I can't describe how much I fell in love with this place. I think particularly after quite a hard few months in Moscow, with this sort of building paranoia, not knowing who you could speak to, and obviously the building sort of clamour of war around me. To be in the free air felt wonderful, but to be in this beautiful place with beautiful food and lovely people and just this great sort of easy, free atmosphere, I felt absolutely so grateful to be there. And I met these local volunteers who ended up putting me up in their boat repair workshop and sort of inviting me around for tea at their family's house. And then I learned all about, as you say, the history of this place. I was there for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I wrote for the LRB, and I wanted to explain a bit of the quite complicated and thorny history. And part of that is that down in the Delta, there's the Lipovans, which they are descendants of 17th century old believers who fled persecution under Tsar Nicholas I. And you can tell these communities because they're still partly Russian speaking. They have the blue and white thatched houses. And in some of these places, then there were Ukrainians were going to stay and being very surprised that they were being met by Russian speakers, who are, of course, I mean, they felt like they were Romanians. They're not sort of even claim to be Russians. But yeah, I mean, identity, ethnicity, everything is very, very twisty down there because there's so many nationalities. There's so many empires have crossed that bit of land and taken it and lost it. And people have this great kind of almost like a shrug, you know, a sort of bemused shrug about all this. And I found one thing I loved there is that people were very proud of where they were from, but with a kind of dry sarcasm, with a kind of irony about it, you know, which I hadn't found in Russia. Obviously, I just got lectured a lot on how wonderful Russia was. So that was all hugely refreshing. And the landscapes are incredible, but I'll not go on about them. Read the book.
I assume you stayed in touch with people from there. Have things changed in that borderland since you were there? Has the empathy with Ukrainians waned at all?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, it's less intense there than it was 2 years ago when there were so many people needing help. This is one of the poorest regions of Romania, which is one of the poorest countries in Europe. And yet the level of generosity was, of course, enormous. Look, it's difficult for them because they're next to Ukraine. And as you know, Russia has been bombing right up to that border. There's been a lot going on in the Danube in terms of Russian attacks and trying to stop shipping. So, you know, these people on that part of Romania, they're very near to the war. They're very close to it. And they're worried, of course. Like most people in that part of the world, they understand full well what Russia is and what Russia can do, just as people in the Baltics and Poland and everywhere do. So it's a place I hope to go back to soon because I haven't been back since June 2022 when I left after the first trip and see how things are.
You go from there to Odessa. And again, it's very striking how you write about Odessa as this place that is quite distinct from the rest of the country. You describe a couple from there as having a almost Parisian dress sense and air of pride. Mm. And you have this interesting conversation with the mayor of Odessa.
Yes, it was an interesting conversation. He's a frankly quite terrifying man, Gennady Trukhanov. He was not enamoured with me, I have to say, at first, because there was a lot of journalists turning, a lot of foreign journalists in the city who were turning up and saying, why are you so pro-Russian? And he was, I mean, understandably quite tired of that. And I didn't say that because it's a stupid thing to say. I wanted to ask about the kind of the nuances of this stuff, the complex identities that Odessa has. Because the day before, I'd been invited to a birthday party of a woman who, you know, it's like a friend of a friend. She didn't even know me. And invited me, sat me down, fed me lots of wine and food and talked at me. And there was this big argument that erupted at the party over Russian relatives. They're all speaking Russian at this point, by the way, because that's their native language. And she and the older women were mostly of the opinion that you could still try and talk to your Russian relatives, that all of this was just a horrible, you know, mistake. They were torn. Whereas the younger ones were very angry and very, you know, fully hating the Russians, understandably again. But when I spoke to her afterwards, you know, outside, she was in tears talking about trying to tie herself almost in knots about, she understood that the bombs were coming from Russia, absolutely. But you can't very quickly overturn an entire lifetime of feeling that you have this brotherly nation, of really believing in that Soviet propaganda that you are all together, you know, friendship of the peoples, and Russia is our brothers. It's very hard for them to overturn that quickly. And they have a lot of Soviet nostalgia because some things were better and some things weren't. And I think that's poorly understood. And this is what I was trying to ask Trukhanov, but the translator, I'd had a translator for the first sort of 10 minutes until I convinced them that I didn't need one. And I think she said pro-Rusky. And he got quite cross. It's a very funny picture of him sort of glaring at me across the table as I try to charm him unsuccessfully. But actually, we did get onto some very interesting things. And I think Trukhanov, I mean, he's actually been arrested since and before that for allegations of improper conduct. And there's a lot of rumours that swirl around him and his past and sort of mafia connections. But I do believe him when he says that he is absolutely for Odessa. And this is the thing about it. My friend says to me, she's from Odessa, and Odessa thinks first and foremost about Odessa. And that doesn't make it separatist, you know, it doesn't make it pro-Russian at all. It just makes it quite a distinct and quirky kind of place, actually. But this was, I mean, all these kind of layers and layers of history and identity that were changing so quickly is why, for me, there was no better place in the world to be at that point. As a writer, also as someone trained in sociology, I mean, it's just a dream to try and dig into all this and even try to understand it.
I mean, I've read a lot of books on Ukraine in the last 2 years, pretty much none before that. And this was the one, I think, that really made me understand what it is people mean by pro-Russian in Ukraine. Because he said, maybe it was someone also from that dinner party you mentioned, pro-Russian as being shorthand for having a common understanding of the Second World War. And that really hit a note for me. And then later you have a conversation with your friend, Victoria Amelina, and she says, "We only looked at one side of the story. There were two monsters, Hitler and Stalin, and the regimes behind them. But in Nuremberg, only the Nazis were tried. There was no justice for the Soviet regime." And this common understanding of the Second World War seems to be a common understanding of the cult of the great victory. And the Russians never learned what it means to be a Nazi. So they chuck around the word Nazi to describe the Ukrainians and the Ukrainian government. Do you think that is at core of what is happening in Russian society and Russian politics? Is that people have not come to terms with their history?
Yes, memory wars. I think this is so important. There was so much that was covered up, forgotten, unspoken in Soviet society, because there was only one narrative that was allowed. There was only one truth that was allowed. And, you know, in Ukraine, that truth was, we came and saved you from the fascists. Hurrah. And of course, many Ukrainians fought in the Red Army as well. And many people would say, how can they do this? My granddad was in the Red Army, you know, and it's a very complicated thing to start uncovering this and unpicking this is deeply, deeply painful. But as Victoria said, she's a very wise woman, this is absolutely necessary to understand what's going on now, and also for the future of Ukraine, for it to have a settled sense of itself and what that history meant, because it's still quite contested. It's still quite painful and difficult. The thing that struck me so much, I think I'm quite a visual person maybe, and I took a lot of pictures of partially destroyed war memorials in deoccupied areas. And these are the layers of irony and the layers of history in this, because they're all the inscriptions are usually in Russian. They always talk about that when this village was liberated from the fascist invaders, meaning the Germans. There's lots and lots of words of fascism and Nazis, and most of these blocks, these statues and so on, have been destroyed or broken by shelling. I mean, how do you read that? You know, if you're a person who lives in that village and I don't know, you're in your 60s and your association with the Second World War is of course that you helped free the world from Nazis, and now you've got the Russians, who you consider actual fascists because of what they're doing and how they speak about you, coming in, and their language is inscribed in it, and it used to be your language, and now you're speaking Ukrainian. I mean, my God, you know, as I said, the kind of shifting sands of identity and historical understanding and memory are so fast and so vivid in this war and in that society that it just set my mind racing.
From the book, women seem to play a central role in this war on active duty and in activist roles. And we just mentioned Victoria Amelina. And it was a shock when at the end of the book, you revealed that she was one of the people killed at the pizzeria in Kramatorsk in June 23. Equally, it's a shock when we learned that a woman you'd met who was on a drone team was also killed outside Bakhmut. Is that something you came across, that women played this central role, or playing this central role in this war?
Yes, I find that all the time. I think because a huge part of the war effort is not even necessarily military, it's the civic networks around that make the military able to function, that supply soldiers so often, that help refugees, that help people live in the cities. You can't underestimate the significance of Ukraine's civic networks, which were there from Maidan kind of times or before, you know, from the previous revolution. They are absolutely crucial, and women are absolutely crucial within that. So many of my friends are volunteers if they're not in the army, and many of those are women. Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to specifically mention Victoria Amelina and Vladislava Chernych. I want us to remember their names, remember their contribution. Victoria was a novelist and poet who'd become a war crimes researcher, and she became my friend, and I valued that friendship so much. She made me laugh a lot, and she was very, very self-deprecating humour, and very, very clever. She's a very clever person. So she helped me understand. She spent a lot of time helping me to understand some of this history. We were talking about the impunity for Soviet crimes and how that links to the Russian psychology today. This is what she was helping me to understand. I think that we, in life generally, we make these bargains that we're not even aware of, with God almost, that, you know, yes, people will die and maybe I'll know some of them, but not that one. And it's almost like a child's response of fury I felt when I heard that she had been in that restaurant, which I'd eaten and everybody eats in that restaurant. It's one of the few places you can get some food in Kramatorsk. It wasn't really real for quite a while. And she lived a few days until she died of her injuries. And it was so, I mean, what we've lost is so huge. And the same with Vladislava Chernych. I mean, that woman, she's 28 years old, star PhD in chemistry, star PhD candidate in Kharkiv. She had been so insistent that she joined this brigade, so insistent, that in the end, the commander had actually gone to pick her up, you know, and her parents said, God, we couldn't stop her. And she, you know, at first she'd been a drone technician and a medic, and then it turned out she was a crack shot, and she was the first woman in the field section of that brigade. When I met her, it was this day, very, very cold day, just up at the Russian border, that front line, where her team were sending reconnaissance drones and then bomber drones. And I actually barely exchanged a word with her, because I've never seen anyone more completely focused and determined and set on their tasks. It was incredible just watching her work. And after she died, I talked to her friends and her family and got more of a picture of her. She died near Bakhmut trying to help one of her comrades. And she was 28 years old. And both of those women have contributed so much to their country, but also to everybody, to all of us, you know, for peace in Europe, for freedom in Europe as well. I know that might sound cheesy, but I don't care. I think that's really true.
There's another female soldier who I don't think you name in Slovyansk, and she says something very haunting, which is, she says, I've made peace with the war, everyone has, but then adds, we all know that we probably won't be alive at the end of the war, we won't survive this. Did you feel this was quite a common sentiment among those at the front line in this war?
In a way, yes. She's referring just to, you know, the guys that she's fighting with, just to be clear, not to sort of a general sentiment in Ukraine, but yes, on the front line. I think it's a psychological thing. It's a coping mechanism, isn't it? When you've been there long enough and you understand what the odds are and how dangerous it is, that's how you deal with fear, is you become not fatalistic, but you accept the large possibility that you will be killed. And it's, yes, it struck me. And I remember wanting to sort of shout, no, you won't, you'll be fine. But that's how she was dealing with it. And I found that admirable in its own way. I'm happy to say that she is still very much alive. But of course, a lot of other people aren't.
Yeah. Well, there's this episode where you actually go to the front line yourself in Donbass in early 2023, and you get in the wrong car, much to the consternation of your commissioning editor, to Siversk instead of Chasiv Yar. obviously, at the moment, this is absolutely the front line. This is a critical town that the Russians are trying to take. It must seem strange and worrying for you at the moment.
Yes, it does. It's awful. It's awful watching the map and seeing these places that I know. I had actually been to the front line before that in late 22 with Ivana. Actually, we went to Kurakova and to some of the frontline positions around there. So that's just near Donetsk. It's a few miles from Donetsk city, which is occupied. So I look on the map and I look at Kurakova and I think of the guys that I met there, lovely guys, like just golden. And I wonder if they're still alive. I wonder what happened to the people in those villages. I see this creeping Russian advance come closer and closer to Konstantinovka. These are real places, you know, these are real, beautiful, beautiful places. And it's very, it feels very personal. It feels very, very vivid. It's not just a map. It's not just, you know, the war reports that you get. Yeah, I mean, the story of going to Siversk was, I suppose I tried to find some humor in that because you find some gallows humor in all sorts of things, don't you? And yes, I was going on an evacuation run with these guys that were going to Chasiv Yar and Siversk and frontline towns to see if people wanted to leave or try and persuade them to leave. And there were two convoys going to different places, and I just happened to be at the petrol station. In my defense, I got there really early because I didn't want to be late and I wanted to be prepared, but there was already a convoy leaving and people with press jackets. And it was just, you know, I said, oh, are you going? Is this the convoy? And yeah, jump in. So I just did. And it took me about 20 minutes as we got onto the sort of higher ground and it was dark roads. And I said, this is a funny direction to go to Chasiv Yar. It was the opposite direction. And this sort of terrible silence in the Jeep. So they all turned around and said, who are you? Where do you think you're going? So, yeah. And Siversk was a little bit, perhaps a little bit hotter than Chasiv Yar at that point. So there was quite a bit of shelling. But, you know, I got home at lunchtime. It was fine, as it so often is. And wrote a story. And now, of course, Chasiv Yar is on the verge of falling to the Russians. And they are destroying every square inch of it, from what I can tell. Yeah.
Do you have any plans to go back?
Yes. Well, I'm going back quite soon for the Lviv Media Forum, which is a really massive media conference that's held in Lviv for many years now. So that'll be very exciting to speak to people. And then I'm kind of flat out with book stuff over the summer, which is nice, obviously, but I'm hoping I can get back in October. I mean, I'm very torn, Tim. Do you know, part of me would like to be in Ukraine all of the time for lots of reasons. I want to be covering this story. I think it's so important and things might get much more vivid and difficult quite soon. Part of me wants to be with my friends and also to be sort of experiencing this with them. And that's, I don't know, some sort of desire to show solidarity, to be there with them as they go through this. And partly, quite frankly, in Eastern Europe, they have central heating. And that's something we don't really have often in Scotland. I'm not being flippant. It's just that like living conditions are actually a lot sometimes better in Ukraine, in places like Kyiv, where there's air defence and things are mostly fine than they are here.
I spent a week in Russia, probably about the same time you were in St. Petersburg. And yeah, the one thing that I was there in February, it was unbelievably cold, but every building was incredibly hot.
Yeah, it's a bit excessive, I agree. And, you know, maybe things will change on that front. But I was talking to my friends actually in Kharkiv and they said, yeah, I mean, I was telling them about the flat that I live in now, which is cold, very cold, a little bit moldy. And they were like, yeah, the thing is a lot of Ukrainian refugees, you know, when they fled to Europe, and some of them would kind of complain about their living conditions they were in because they were used to something quite a lot better. And I think it really speaks to that almost colonialism, that way that Western Europe looks down on Eastern Europe, particularly Ukraine, as this sort of grey ex-Soviet place where everything's a bit terrible, forgetting that some things are really good there, that living conditions have been rising quickly there. Yeah, I just think it's an interesting reflection that we sometimes forget.
To finish, as always, because this is a podcast about books, I've asked my guest to recommend two, one broadly from the field and one entirely personal choice. So, Jen, what have you chosen?
I already spoke about Martha Gellhorn, but I'm going to speak about her again briefly. So if I had to choose one, I guess we could choose The Face of War because it's very relevant to this topic. But I'd say that her letters are actually equally incredible to read if you get a chance. So, I mean, I talked about her already. And about the kind of reporting she did It was very intrepid. It was very easily romanticized, her life. And actually, you know, I think it was very difficult, particularly being married to Hemingway. But one of the things she did, she was very analytical as well and very impassioned. And could I like read a very short excerpt from what she said about that war? Because I think it really is very relevant today. To get a war started, you need an aggressor, a government so ambitious, so greedy, that the vital interests of its state require foreign conquest. But an aggressor government sells its people the project of war as a defensive measure. They are being threatened, encircled, pushed around. Enemies are poised to attack them. It's sadly easy to make people believe any lies. People are pitifully gullible, subject to instant flag waving and misguided patriotism. And once the war starts, the government's in total control. People must obey the orders, even if their early induced enthusiasm has waned. The nation or nations that are attacked here have no choice except to fight the aggressor. But would not competent governments have seen the menace and taken early action to prevent the aggressor from completing preparations for war? I mean, well, indeed, no?
Absolutely, yeah.
The other book, very personal book, I said I'm an optimist for some reason about humanity. I never like reading dystopias. I think they're easy and a bit of a cop-out. It's really easy to imagine how terrible things could be in lots of different ways. I always loved reading utopias, because that's very difficult, actually. So you can keep your Brave New World in 1984. My favourite book for many years was The Island by Aldous Huxley. And he wrote this towards the end of his life. It's an insight into his mind and his spirituality and his beliefs about humanity and truth and beauty. And this sounds terribly earnest, but the book is also extremely funny. So yeah, he has this sympathetic, like brutally honest depiction of the slowly disintegrating British man, Will. And it's just this portrayal of kind of absurdity and tragedy of British stiff upper lip. It's a beautiful book.
Well, thank you. Today I've been talking to Jen Stout about Night Train to Odessa, published today by Polygon. Jen, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you.